Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
What do we want?
Project!
When do we want it?
Now!
When do we want it?
Now!
When do we want it?
Now!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
In November, workers with Unite Here Local 274 protested outside the Philadelphia airport, where their employer, OTG Management, operates 6 restaurants. They were protesting for access to better health care. It's been a remarkable year overall for the labor movement in America. The Philly action was among the 1,000 labor protests and 357 union strikes across the country this year, according to the Labor Action Tracker at Cornell University. But it's not just labor actions that are on the rise. In September, in a Gallup poll, 68% of those surveyed said they approve of unions, the highest level of public support since 1965. Mike Burlingham is one of the thousands of workers who went on strike in 2021.
It's really cool when I go to my kids' school and I tell them that I work at a place right down the road that makes Oreo cookies. And, you know, you say Oreos and people light up, adults light up. You say Oreos and they're like, you make Oreos? You know, it's fun. It's one of those things everybody knows it. It's a staple. It's America's favorite cookie. So, you know, there's a lot of pride that does go into what we do.
Burlingham works at Nabisco's Portland, Oregon factory. He's been there for 14 years. And he says the strike was a long time coming, but the pandemic really was the last straw. And he spoke with us at work on his lunch break.
A lot of businesses closed, restaurants and such closed down during the pandemic. People are staying at home, but yet snack foods thrived. And so they needed to keep these lines running. So production ramped up, we're understaffed, and there was a lot of force over time, daily, weeks on end, people not getting a day off. The folks are tired and they need a day off, but the company doesn't care about that. It's extremely draining. And for me, you know, it impacts the family. I got 2 very young children. And they're always asking me, do you have to work this weekend? And when I say yes, it's a collective, aw, you know, they're upset. They want to spend time with me. And I'm watching them grow up. And I'm kind of at a point right now. I'm like, man, I feel like I've missed a lot of time with my kids. You know, and that takes a toll on your mental health. I spend more time with my coworkers than I do with my very own family. And, you know, that's sad. So we made the decision at that time to go out on strike, and then that came to a head on August 10th. We walked out at noon our time. The energy was positive. I had never seen so many smiling faces, which that's a crazy thing to say. You know, people walking out on their job and willingly saying that I am willing to take to the street and not get a paycheck and potentially lose everything for this cause, and to do so with a huge grin on your face. I mean, what does that say? I mean, that just talks volumes about what the conditions here were like. It's a scary thing to go out on strike because you don't know what the outcome is going to be. You don't know how long you're going to be out there. It could be a day, a week, in our case, 40 days. And 40 days feels like forever. Our demands were fairly simple. We didn't even really have demands other than we want to maintain what we currently have. The company has taken enough. There was one time that they did meet with our bargaining unit. It basically, what they did is they slid the last proposal they had across the table and said, we are unwilling to budge from this. And our bargaining unit said, well, I guess we don't have anything to discuss if you're unwilling to actually bargain with us. So to come to the table and to overwork people during a pandemic while at the same time making record profit after record profit, to come and say, in order for us to remain competitive in this market, we need you, the essential worker, to accept less. I'm sorry, but where in the world does that make sense? I had the mentality of one day longer. So whenever I was asked, you know, how long are you guys willing to stay out? One day longer than the company. That's how long. For me, my mindset is always as long as it takes to get this done. And there's jobs out there. And would I be accepting longer hours, less pay? Perhaps. Yeah. But, you know, I am willing to stand up and fight for what I believe the right thing to do is. And I'm willing to take less elsewhere than to give it to this company. What they brought to the table is full maintenance of benefits. So maintaining what we currently have as far as our healthcare package. They did improve the 401k matching. You know, the company's going to continue to run on the weekends. They want the lines running 24/7, as little shut down as possible. So their answer to that was this weekend crew to bring more people in. That way there's less forced overtime on the weekend. We could have done better. We literally accepted the first thing that was negotiated. We could have sent them back to the table and said, do better. You know, I would hope that the company knows that we have a backbone and we will go out on strike if we're pushed to do so. We've done it before and we can do it again.
Mike Burlingham, a worker at a Nabisco factory in Portland, Oregon. They went on strike for more than a month earlier this year. Glenn Walter, an executive vice president of North America for Mondelez, the company that runs the factory, said in a statement, quote, "Our goal has always been to reach agreements that would provide our union represented colleagues with good wages and competitive benefits while also positioning our U.S. bakeries and sales distribution facilities for future growth and success," end quote. Well, Stephen Greenhouse joins us now. He's a labor and workplace journalist who spent 3 decades at the New York Times. He's also author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Meghna. I love your show.
Well, I should, before we go any further, in the interest of full disclosure, as we are talking about unions this hour, the newsroom at my home station, WBUR, was unionized in 2019. And as a result, I am a member of SAG-AFTRA. So, Stephen, let's first start with what you heard in Mike's story there at the Nabisco factory in Portland. What does it reflect about what the labor movement experienced in 2021?
So what Mike said captured so much of what I'm seeing and what many workers are saying, that the pandemic really shined a very bright light on what are often very harsh working conditions, usually long hours, stress, not seeing one's family enough. And then, you know, these workers feel, I've given my all, I've risked my life day after day, while the CEOs and all the white-collar workers who are pulling in $150,000, $200,000 a year are working at home and they have it much easier. And then when they come to contract negotiations, these workers feel that management wants concessions from them. They expect, you know, if we've worked so much, we deserve a generous offer. And, you know, what Mike conveyed was that there's a sense of anger, frustration, dissatisfaction, disgruntlement with many, many workers. That's why we saw the strikes, not just at Nabisco, but at Kellogg's and John Deere, and why we're seeing these unionization efforts at Starbucks and Amazon, and why we're seeing, you know, the so-called Great Resignation, Meghna, where a record number of workers are quitting their jobs each year out of dissatisfaction that they're not being paid enough, that they're not being treated well enough. You know, over the past few months, 4 million workers, 4 million plus workers have been quitting their jobs each year. That is a record. And that is really sending a message that, hey, during the pandemic, we American workers are seeing, have decided that, you know, just too many employers are not treating their workers well enough and not rewarding them for the hard work they've done, the dangerous work they've done during the pandemic, and that we want better.
So as we've been saying for a couple of years now, it's the mirror, right? That the pandemic being the mirror that's reflecting back the truth about American society. But writ large, Stephen, there was a bunch of statistics I offered at the top of the show, including the number of labor actions and strikes, and then that approval rating from Gallup, which we'll dig into a little bit, though. I mean, collectively, does it signal some kind of, inflection point in the labor movement in this country, or is this just an anomalous year because of the pandemic?
Magna, it's clearly a resurgence, reawakening of collective action. I do think that because of the pandemic, so many workers just were frustrated and angry that, you know, they've really risked their lives. You know, the meatpacking workers, grocery workers, and then, you know, many, many workers have died. You know, I'm in New York City. So many transit, over 100 transit workers have died of COVID. And they feel they risk their lives every day, and that's caused kind of a great reassessment of our job. Am I treated well enough? You know, this is what I do with 40, 50, 60 hours of my life each week. And do I deserve better? Should I be paid better? Should I be treated better? So I think the pandemic did cause this inflection point. Now, the question is whether this will lead to a longer lasting resurgence of anger and collective action and strikes and protests, or whether this is just kind of a one-time, one-year flash in the pan until the pandemic is over, God, if it ever ends. So, you know, the jury is out on whether we will see more of this next year and the year after and the year after. But we're seeing things like, you know, we saw this unionization of Starbucks in Buffalo. Now, two Starbucks in the Boston area have petitioned for a union election, another one in Arizona, another one in Seattle. So this kind of anger, this desire for change seems to be spreading. Now, whether it will catch fire totally, the jury's out on that.
Mm. Well, we are talking this hour about a collection of rather remarkable statistics about the labor movement in the United States in 2021. And as you just heard Stephen Greenhouse explore with me, whether or not it represents a true inflection point in the labor movement in this country. So we'll have a lot more stories when we come back, and hop on social media on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. And let us know what you think. If you are a member of the labor movement, did this year feel different than past years in terms of how successful actions were? And if you are in management or an employer that's undergone a unionization drive, for example, where you are, what was that like? We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a look at 2021 and the labor movement in this country, and whether a significant rise in the number of union drives, labor actions, and strikes signifies a kind of turning point for labor in this country. And I'm joined today by Stephen Greenhouse. He is a labor and workplace journalist, covered labor at the New York Times for 30 years, and now is also author of Beaten Down and Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Let's listen to a moment to Saru Jayaraman, a co-founder and president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. We talked to her earlier this week about what this moment means for labor.
This truly is a moment very similar to 100 years ago when workers were first starting to form unions and didn't really have any structures in place. It's sort of like thinking as if this is another moment like that, where we have a chance to recreate our economy because workers across so many sectors are pushing back. And it would be so limiting to say the only thing we're going to care about or support is the less than 1 in 10 workers that currently have or might have access to a union. No, instead, we need to support and lift up and elevate all of the workers who are fighting for change in all the different sectors, whether they're union or not.
So Stephen Greenhouse, springboarding off that, I do want to kind of dissect a little bit what these individual statistics about 2021 and the labor movement actually might mean. Because collectively, they seem significant. But Saru seemed to just brush away what I think is an important piece of context here that we shouldn't ignore, that still to this day, and as it has been for decades now, labor union membership in this country is less than 10% of U.S. adults. That number might be rising ever so slightly, but it hasn't really significantly budged, regardless of all the activity that we've seen this year. What do you think about that?
So in the 1950s, you know, more than one in three American adults were in labor unions. Now it's slightly more than 10%. You know, one in 10 are in unions now. And, you know, there are many reasons for that. You know, the decline of manufacturing factories, so many factory closings, which was long the base of labor. American companies since the 1980s and the Reagan era have gotten far, far more aggressive in fighting against unions, as we saw over the past year at Amazon and at Starbucks. And there's been a huge growth of the service sector, fast food, banking, beauty salons, and those are much harder to unionize generally than the steel industry and the auto industry. So all, you know, those and many other factors have caused the percentage of workers in unions to decline. But at the same time, as you mentioned before, there's this most recent Gallup poll that says that 68% of Americans approve of unions, and even better news for labor, 77% of young Americans age 18 to 34 support unions. And that's a very promising note. And so why are so many people approving of unions? Why are we seeing a lot of young Americans, you know, grad students, museum workers, people for nonprofits, adjunct professors, people in my profession, journalism, especially young digital journalists, are really flocking in a big way into unions. Some podcasts, big podcasts have recently unionized. So I think a lot of workers feel, hey, there's something really broken in the American economy. Stock market keeps hitting records, corporate profits keep hitting records. Yet until very recently, with the pandemic, basically wages were flat for many, you know, for millions and millions, for most workers over the years. And I think for young people, you know, they finish college, maybe they didn't finish college, and they have lots of student debt, and they face high rents, and they hear, you know, these news reports saying, you will be the first generation in American history, you know, where you're going to do worse economically than your parents. And they watch NFL, or they watch NBA games, and they see these BMW and Mercedes-Benz commercials and say, hey, I work very hard, but I can't begin to afford that stuff. And that's something, and there's something very wrong.
Yeah. So, well, can I just jump in here for a second, Stephen?
Sure.
If I may, so that Gallup poll, since it's come up quite a few times, I have to say I read it a little bit differently, so, and would love to engage you in conversation about that. Because, yes, that number from September was 68% of Americans approve of labor unions. And the last time the number was up in that territory was in 1965, when it was 71%. But Gallup's been making this measure since 1936. And there's additional context here, which you well know, which is in every year since 1936, except for one, approval has always been above 50%. And that one single anomalous year was 2009, interestingly. So there's kind of a multiple parts to this. So even as support for labor unions has been historically above 50% in this country, we've had that similar sort of decline in union membership. So does the support, public support, really matter much in the long run when it comes to the labor movement in this country?
Magda, that's a great question. You know, I wrote this book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, where I talk about this crazy disconnect where many, many workers support unions, approve of unions, yet, you know, 68% support unions. There's this terrific MIT study that basically says one in two non-union workers in the United States say they'd vote to join a union tomorrow if they could, yet only one in 10 workers are in unions and only one in six in the private sector. And as explained in my book, the main reason for that, I believe, is that American corporations fight harder to keep out unions than corporations in any other advanced industrial nation. And there's kind of this American exceptionalism where corporations, you know, in the United States see unions as the enemy. They will do everything they can to keep unions out, whereas you know, companies in Western Europe, for instance, in Germany, you know, where they're very successful unionized companies like Mercedes-Benz and Daimler, and Japan where very successful unionized companies like Toyota, Honda, you know, they see unions, maybe they don't love unions, but they see them as partners that we're going to work with to build more prosperous, productive companies. But here in the United States, companies, as we saw in Amazon, where Amazon pulled out all the stops, and Starbucks in Buffalo, where even, you know, Howard Schultz, the founder of Starbucks, went and spoke to workers to tell them they shouldn't vote for a union. Mm. So I think a lot of workers feel that they're not getting a fair shake, and they've been trying to figure out ways to improve things for themselves. And I think this increasing disgruntlement we've seen in recent years has led to more workers saying, hey, unions are a good idea. They could lift us collectively.
Right. So in the case of the Amazon union drive in Bessemer, Alabama, just to be clear, two things happened there. One is that the workers there voted against unionization, but more recently, the National Labor Relations Board has found that Amazon basically acted egregiously and violated labor laws around that labor drive in terms of their lobbying, I should say, against the union. So that is still an open question about what might happen in Bessemer, Alabama. But we also keep talking about Starbucks here. They've got thousands of stores across the United States. You could see the successful union drive in Buffalo and in the couple other places we mentioned as perhaps an important crack in the edifice of the corporation that is Starbucks that could grow, or it just might be just that, just a crack. We just don't know yet.
This goes back to your initial point, Meghna. You know, is this just an inflection point? Is this, you know, just a one-off, or is this really an inflection point? We're going to see a surge in unionization. And I do think a lot of workers are really interested in unionization. But the question is whether, you know, larger organized labor, whether the capital L, capital M labor movement is really going to jump on this and say, we're going to try to really harness this effort to enable far more workers to unionize. I haven't seen that, even though, to my mind, workers at many of the 8,900 corporate-owned Starbucks in the U.S. probably say, hey, you know, it would be a good idea to have a union. We could probably get better schedules, better pay. But it's really unclear whether the labor movement will do enough to harness that enthusiasm of people who want a union. Mm. With regard to Amazon, I wrote extensively about the unionization effort in Alabama. And to me, it really showed how uneven the playing field is when workers want to unionize. Companies like Amazon and Starbucks say, we think it should be up to the workers. But then managers, you know, bang workers over the head, you know, 24/7 about why they shouldn't support unions, why unions are corrupt, why unions only want their dues money. And you know, companies can bring in anti-union consultants, can force people to attend anti-union meetings, could show anti-union videos in the lunchroom, can have big anti-union banners. And at the same time, under American law, companies like Amazon can prohibit union organizers from setting foot on company property to speak to workers. So there's this huge imbalance when there are unionization drives. And that's why, you know, workers at Amazon who want a union have a hard time persuading the majority to support a union, because Amazon kind of has this very loud megaphone telling people, you really don't want a union, you really don't want a union, and kind of threatening, well, if you have a union, things might go bad.
Mm. Well, we'll see what continues to happen in Bessemer, Alabama there. But regarding the Buffalo store, the Starbucks store in Buffalo, just want to note that Roseanne Williams, Starbucks executive vice president and president of U.S. retail and Canadian retail, said in a statement, quote, from the beginning, we've been clear in our belief that we do not want a union between us as partners, and that conviction has not changed. But she also added that we have also said we respect the legal process, insisting that the company will bargain in good faith with the union that represents partners in the one Buffalo store. Now, Stephen, focusing on the food service industry a little bit more here. Obviously, this is one sector in which the pandemic has laid waste to much of the food service industry, particularly restaurants, as we know. The National Restaurant Association has reported that 10,000 food and beverage establishments closed permanently in 2020 alone. But for workers still in the industry, there remain many challenges.
I think a lot of people who work in food service are generally working hard to make ends meet. It's a tough job to be in general, but when you add the conditions of a pandemic, you know, all of these bigger societal problems of, you know, healthcare being so expensive and all of these things makes people a little bit more willing to take a risk, because when conditions are as dire as they are, people are willing to try new things, or I guess bring back things like unions that were once really, really powerful and helped bring a lot of people into more stable conditions in this country in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. I think we're seeing, let's do that again.
John Lazaroff is a 22-year-old worker at Pavement Coffee House, a Boston coffee chain with 75 employees at 8 locations. He and other Pavement workers launched a union drive this summer.
I immediately was really, really excited about all of this. You know, I just graduated from school. I didn't have a lot going on, and this was something that meant a lot to me to be able to kind of throw myself into and really get involved.
Pavement Coffee House's owner, Larry Margulies, voluntarily recognized the union in June. He wrote in an op-ed this summer that he understands why young workers are turning to a union to confront structural problems such as high rent, high college loan debt, and low wages. But Margulies wrote, quote, "Will unionizing Pavement, a small business with 75 employees and no investors, fix any of that? Probably not." But then he goes on and says, "But if I was 21 years old, I'm not so sure I wouldn't have signed that union card myself, if only for the chance it offered to put a few more dollars in my pocket and the sense of empowerment and solidarity it would give me," end quote. Well, worker John Lazaroff says empowerment is what the union drive is all about.
Customers were unbelievably supportive. We had people coming in that first day saying, you know, like, "I could have gotten this coffee anywhere, but I'm coming here to get it today to support you guys. Tell your boss that," which was really, really cool. We are still in the process of negotiating a contract. Many of the original organizers have left. That was part of the reason why people were so willing at the beginning to get involved before we even went public, was people were really fed up and were planning on leaving soon anyways, and kind of thought, you know, might as well give it a go and try to make this place better before I leave, which they sure did. But I will say, you know, it doesn't feel like a whole lot has changed. I think we're all still pretty frustrated that our voices aren't being heard in a lot of ways. And I do think that this momentum has legs. I think people in general are pretty fed up. So much has happened in the last 2 years alone that has really gotten people to open their eyes to the way that things are and the way that things could be, and what conventional wisdom might say about the correct way to do that, or, you know, what's possible and what's not possible. But we're only limiting ourselves when we do that. And so I think people now more than ever are willing to imagine newer futures, more open to possibilities like unionizing, and frankly have a lot less to lose.
Pavement coffee shop worker John Lazaroff. Stephen Greenhouse, we've got about 2 minutes left before the next break. You know, another interesting thing that John told us was that his interest in supporting the union drive at the Pavement Coffee House, little mini chain here in the Boston area, wasn't limited to economic interests. That, in fact, there were sort of social changes that he and his fellow coworkers wanted to see in the workplace. Is that something that we're also seeing, sort of workers turning to unions to help with sort of social and cultural change as well?
Yes, we're seeing that increasingly. For instance, in California, where housing, you know, in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, where housing is so insanely expensive, we're seeing unions in their negotiations, you know, trying to push for some help with housing subsidies. And we're seeing some unions pushing for, you know, more diversity, more attention to, you know, to issues of racial fairness, of making sure that women are paid fairly, that LGBTQ workers are treated fairly. So we're seeing movement beyond basic economic issues. And, you know, when a union pushes for instance, help with higher housing prices, unions are often reaching out to the community to say, you know, we want to help ourselves. We want to help you with the problem of affordable rents. And so we're seeing more union support of the community and more community support of unions. I think that's another reason why public approval for unions has increased, because unions are often, you know, fighting for community members on different issues.
So just 30 seconds quickly before the break, Stephen, but are some of these social things the purview of, like, does it fall under labor law? If a union says, well, we want you to hire more workers of color, is that something that labor law actually covers regarding what unions can and can't demand?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, if basically labor law says you can only bargain over things clearly involving, you know, wages and conditions of work. But, you know, whether you have an integrated workplace, one could say, or, you know, racial equity in the workplace, one could say that's an important working condition. Mm. So there are ways where, even if it's not covered by labor law, unions can pressure the employer to negotiate.
Well, Stephen Greenhouse, stand by. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and tomorrow, just want to give you a little heads up, we're going to be talking about the metaverse, you know, that promise of an interconnected three-dimensional internet that looks and feels a lot like the real world, cities, music festivals, et cetera, but it's all virtual. We want to know if you welcome the coming of the metaverse, or if you already wonder how much of digital life and virtual reality is having an impact on our actual reality. Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about a really interesting year that the labor movement has had in the United States in terms of a record number of labor actions and strikes and a recent high in the public approval of unions in America. So, yes, 2021 was a remarkable year, but of course, one data point does not a pattern make. So we're trying to understand what we should be looking for in order to see if this is truly a turning point for labor in America. And I'm joined today by Stephen Greenhouse. He's author of Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. He's been reporting on labor for decades now. And let me bring Jeff Farmer into the conversation. He's director of organizing at the Teamsters. He's been there since 2002, was also previously active in several unions in Minnesota. Jeff Farmer, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Does this year feel any different than it has in the past for you?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing a renewed interest in unions, as you were discussing. As a union, we're seeing more and more inquiries from workers across the spectrum, from typically kind of core industries to new industries that kind of surprise many people. For example, our union recently organized 500 AAA insurance agents in the Bay Area. Workers there who are making a sizable income, they decided to form a union to join the Teamsters because of the same issues that other workers face. Lack of a voice, in some cases disrespect, just the interest in having a say in their future.
Yeah. You know, so, if I can just jump in here, Stephen said something really interesting a little earlier in the show. I wanted to see what you think about that, Jeff. And that is, not only is there this sort of upward trend from 2009 onwards in the approval, public approval rating of unions, but the numbers are even higher amongst younger Americans. And what fascinates me about that is they don't seem to have any of the perceptions of unions that people of a generation or two ago might have legitimately had, you know, about the problems of corruption, for example. That literally has not come up in any of the conversations we had in preparing for this show. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, workers, you know, have their eyes on the prize. And I thought it was interesting when you interviewed the coffee house worker, John. He described that he had, you know, they feel that in some respects they have less to lose by trying to form a union. And, we've seen, again, in another industry, the cannabis industry, which is, you know, set to take off like a boom, workers there, primarily young workers far and away, it's very interesting what they're saying. Mm. For the most part, their concerns are not about wages and benefits. They're about, again, having a voice on the job, being part of an industry. Very interestingly to me is that they want these jobs to be a profession, to be a career, as opposed to just being a job. So they're looking long term. In many cases, they're well educated. They know the industry quite well. And so I think that regardless of age or industry, there's just an increased interest in forming unions. However, I think as was discussed earlier, the big factor is to me is always not for workers is not, you know, can we win better wages and benefits? I think typically the biggest issue is if we do this, can we win? Mm-hmm. Because the fear factor that workers face as a result of, you know, the union busting industry and their employer opposition, antiquated labor laws haven't kept up with the changing world of work. So I think this fear of what's going to happen to them if they do organize, I think that that's really the biggest question. And especially with workers who feel like they have less to lose, are willing to take the risk. I think we're seeing some really important developments.
Okay, but you also said something which I don't want to fully let go. Mm-hmm. That is that for especially for younger workers who are looking to unions. If I heard you right, you said that the issue wasn't so much one of wages or benefits, but having a voice in their industry. Now, that's quite a remarkable thing, right? Because, I mean, historically, unions have been seen as the instrument to claw back the division of power between labor and capital. And so when young people say the union will help provide them a voice, or what does that – for the folks you've talked to, what does that actually mean? What is it tangibly that the union can help them achieve in that if it's not, you know, the bread and butter aspects of benefits and wages?
Well, I think there's several things. And when I say that, you know, that the focus in many cases is not – solely on wages and benefits, you know, there are a number of issues like scheduling, for example, or, opportunities for advancement in the workplace. So in the case of the cannabis workers I mentioned, they're interested in a long-term career. But your point about, you know, labor versus capital, one of the things that they're very, very well aware of is that this industry is now on the way to being a multi-billion-dollar industry. So, in that sense, you know, they want a piece of this growth. They want to, you know, not only, you know, win a voice and on important workplace issues, but they realize that this industry is going to skyrocket, and they want to be in on the ground floor. and get their fair share.
Stephen Greenhouse, jump in here. What do you think?
So I think with a lot of young people, you know, they're out of high school, they're out of college, and their professors, the high school teachers are, you know, what do you think? I want to hear what you have to say. What is your opinion? That when people get into the workplace, they feel they're often just not listened to, and they're not used to that. And I think that's the point Jeff's making. A lot of people, you know, that we supposedly, you know, we're in a democracy, you know, everyone supposedly has a voice. But inside many, many companies, many workplaces, you know, workers' voices are largely ignored, and it's, you know, do what the manager says or else. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why so many young people who are idealistic, who want to have a voice, who want to change society to make it better, want to change their workplace to make it better. That's why I think a lot of them see unions as a way to change. And to go back to your first point, Magda, so, you know, older Americans are not as enthusiastic about unions, according to the Gallup poll, as younger Americans. And I think they remember when, you know, they saw on the waterfront and saw how corrupt, for instance, the Longshoremen's Union was. And, you know, I was speaking to a class a few weeks ago, and I asked, you know, the young people, you know, have you seen On the Waterfront? Most of them have never even heard of the movie On the Waterfront. So a lot of young people, they are not familiar with, you know, this unfortunate history of union corruption. And unions have gotten much, much less corrupt in recent decades. And you know, at this point, I think unions are no more corrupt than many businesses and many politicians. And a lot of young people just see the good in unions. They see, you know, other young people trying to unionize at Starbucks or Starbucks or friends or grad students or folks who are working at museums. And now there's this huge unionization effort at the Art Institute of Chicago, where 600 people are trying to unionize. So I think among a lot of young people, there's true excitement about unions and how to improve their workplaces.
Yeah, of course, none of this is black and white, right? Because I think there's another whole sector of unions, thinking of teachers' unions, for example, which are in places where there are influential teachers' unions. They do exercise a lot of power in terms of how you know, a school district operates. And there are many places in this country where I think families have been disappointed in how the unions have operated because the unions have done their jobs. They have represented their members, but in so doing, oftentimes, you know, schools have remained closed, for example, and there are other people beyond the union membership itself that have suffered, for example. So, you know, it depends on where you are in life and what union you're interacting with or a part of. The picture can get very gray here. Now, look, we've got a really terrific comment that's come in from one of our listeners. This is Tim Wells on Facebook, who, when we were talking about Starbucks earlier, he points out that Starbucks pays its employees more, provides health care and educational benefits, and has acted responsibly and offers better overall compensation than others in the industry. But they are targeted to be unionized. And he said no good deed goes unpunished. But he points out something maybe underlying this. He says the failure of our politicians to properly balance the relationship between workers and capital leads to unions. But unions end up acting just like management and shareholders in their quest for power and advantage. They don't seek fairness or intelligent rules either. So government needs to step in and pass universal health care, a higher minimum wage, parental leave, 401k matching, etc. Short of that, Jeff Farmer, I'm going to turn back to you. When we don't have those national policies in place, unions fill the gap. What do you think?
Well, I certainly agree that government should play an extremely active role in providing the kinds of sustainable benefits that, you know, that American families need. There's no question that there should be national health insurance and other, you know, child care provisions and so forth. But I think there's always going to be a role for unions, regardless of what federal policies are, federal programs, because, again, it goes back to this idea that, you know, workers want to have some say. I completely agree with Stephen that, you know, workers, I've heard it, you know, a number of times that, you know, listen, I make decisions every day of my life, in my personal life. I make decisions about what car to buy or what bank to put my money in. But when it comes to my workplace, I have to give all that up, and I have no say whatsoever. So I think that's going to be that role of unions is going to be key going forward, just as it was, in the past.
Mm. Well, I want to talk for a second about what has been happening on Capitol Hill. Much earlier this year, House Democrats did approve a bill called the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act, in a 225 to 206 vote that would essentially further protect or empower workers to collectively organize. Of course, the bill did receive lots of no votes. And here's House Republican from Virginia. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. House Republican Virginia Fox, who spoke on the House floor about why she opposed the legislation.
I rise today in opposition to the radical, partisan, and utterly shameful PRO Act. This unnecessary bill is an assault on American workers, employers, and the economy. The Pro-Union Bosses Act that Democrats have disingenuously titled the PRO Act is a left-wing wish list of union boss priorities, which undermines the rights of workers by forcing them to pay into a union system, whether or not they want to be represented by a union.
Now, Stephen Greenhouse, the PRO Act was passed by the House when it was previously introduced, never made it through the Senate. This time, the Democrats, of course, narrowly control the Senate, but I don't know if the PRO Act had any better luck this time around.
I loved how Representative Fox said a bill that would make it easy to unionize is bad for workers, is anti-workers. The House passed it. Every Republican voted against. Now, in the Senate, it faces a filibuster. It needs 60 votes, and this will be the fourth Democratic president pushing for legislation to make it easier to unionize, and every time Republicans block it with a filibuster. That happened with Lyndon Johnson, it happened with Bill Clinton, it happened with Barack Obama, and now it's probably going to happen with Joe Biden. And, one of the reasons we're seeing a decline in the percentage of workers in unions is that the law has not been updated. And as I said before, the playing field is in many ways tilted in favor of companies when their unionization drives. Companies can't even be fined a dollar if they fire, for instance, the 10 top workers in favor of unions. So that's why a lot of Democrats and union leaders say, hey, we need a law to make it easier to unionize. The fact that unions have grown so weak in the United States has meant that unions can no longer be the countervailing power we need to corporate power to help make sure we have a fairer economic system.
Yeah. Well, just a small correction here before I forget. NPR in March reported that 5 Republicans actually joined Democrats in favor of passing the bill. So not every Republican voted against it. But still, to your point, the majority of them did. Jeff Farmer, look, we have 1 minute left here. And what I'd like to hear from you is, we're talking about a remarkable year for the labor movement in America. And as I said earlier, one is not a pattern. So what do you think you would need to see in order to feel more confident in saying that there's something different going on with labor in America? And how long do you think how many years in the future do you think you're looking out to see if there's been a permanent change here?
Well, that's a tough and good question. I think several things are needed. One is, first and foremost, just an all-out commitment on the part of the labor movement to not only organize millions of workers, but to support workers who just on their own, collectively rise up and challenge corporate power. So I think that commitment's important. I think we also have to put our money and our support where our mouth is. We've talked this past year or so about essential employees. And I think workers themselves are seeing, the power that they hold. They've been inspiring each other with strikes and organizing drives. So I think they're realizing their own power as essential workers. And I think the public, support for unions and workers has increased as a result. So,
well, Jeff, I'm going to take it back from you there because we're just out of time. Jeff Farmer, Director of Organizing at the Teamsters, thank you so much for joining us. And Stephen Greenhouse, thank you as well. This is On Point.